is the Friday Report.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the show. It is the Friday Report, 10 minutes after one. And joining me on the programme today, as you may have just heard, Karen Baker, who's the Chief Executive of the Isle of Wight NHS Trust, and Andy Hollibourn, who's Head of Comms. Welcome to the studio, both of you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Lucy.
Thanks for joining me today. So, as always, you can get your comments and questions in over the next 50 minutes or so. You can text us, IW, a space, and your message. Send it in to 81222. You can tweet us, we're at iWhite Radio. And you can call us, 822002. Do bear with me if you call in live, by the way, because it does take a little bit of time to get you to actually put your points across. So don't be put off if we don't answer straight away. So all of those ways to have your say today. You can head to Facebook as well. And when we come back, we will talk about an increase in emergency admissions to St Mary's Hospital and the recent CQC report.
The Friday Report with Lucy Morgan on Isle of Wight Radio.
Welcome back. It's 13 minutes after one, and this is the Friday Report, a health special today. And Karen Baker, Chief Executive from the Isle of Wight NHS Trust, we have to kick off with something that's just hit the news desk within the last hour or so. There's been an increase in emergency admissions to St Mary's Hospital, and it's causing significant pressure on health services. Apologies to those affected by delays and reassurances that everyone's trying to fix it. But, I mean, this is another in a series of problems for the Trust. Over the last few months, you've had a black alert since October. You've had a near black alert since October, and here we are again. What's going wrong?
Well, the fact is, Lucy, this is the worst winter I've ever lived through in the NHS. I've been in the NHS for about 35 years now, and in common with everybody else, we've seen a real surge in emergency attendances and emergency admissions. There are many factors involved in it, and I suppose there are some facts and figures that would be interesting. So we've had nearly 10% increase in attendances to accident and emergency. Our conversion, and people say, well, is that because they're coming for the right reasons? There'll always be a small number of people that come not for the right reasons. But what we've seen is that those patients attending A&E are converting to hospital admissions. So they're up to 17%. Now, usually we run at about 11 or 12%. So you can see that the population are sicker. So there are genuine reasons for them coming to A&E. We then have to admit them. And admissions this year, 30% up on last year. Patients are older, so patients over 85, again, that's gone up from 6% to 10%. And we know that those patients will be much more complex and more difficult to discharge. They have to stay with us for a longer period of time. Because I think people say, well, you know, it's winter pressures. Surely winter comes every year. But I can honestly say I've never seen a winter like this in the NHS before.
And where do you put the cause for that? Is it the fact that the Isle of Wight's population is ageing? People are more susceptible to things? Is it because there is a lower availability of doctors, for example, so people aren't going to get their sniffles sorted out sooner and they're developing into more serious things? Where's the problem?
Well, as with everything, it is complex, isn't it? Certainly we've got an ageing population, and having those admissions from those patients who are over the age of 85, they're clearly much more complex, and that puts an additional pressure on. I suppose the other thing to say is that it's also difficult to get them out of the hospital. So at any one time, we have somewhere in the region of 24, 25 patients who don't need to be in hospital, and that's a whole ward's worth.
And why is that? Is that because they're not being discharged quick enough because you haven't got the staff to do it? Is that because there is nowhere for them to go?
I think, again, it's a number of reasons. So certainly getting them out into the community can be problematic. And I think we work very, very closely with the local authority so that we can be responsive to the needs of patients when they go back into the community. But that is a large number of patients, and it could be as many as 51. I think, you know, that's where the pressures are. So if you take all of that together, increasing numbers, increasing in the age of the population, increasing admissions, and a difficulty in discharging patients, you can see why this year it is completely different. And the stats that I've quoted there are compared with last year. So it's very, very different this year.
Mr. Price, who's a retired registered nurse, this is what you get for closing Ryde Hospital. Is it a lack of facilities, a lack of places for people to go? You don't have that kind of cottage hospital, that kind of outreach care anymore?
Crikey. Right, I don't know when Ryde Hospital closed. I've been here on the island for about 5 years, and I don't remember when that was. But the question about cottage hospitals, now, modern healthcare is very different to healthcare in the past, and I think it's important for us to respond to what's happening at the time. And closing those cottage hospitals was the right thing to do at the time, centralising care into one place. Now, I think, again, we still need to think about what it needs to look like in the future, and certainly we need some more provision back out in the community now because our population's ageing, so that profile is increasing. I think when we closed Ryde, and that must be a long time ago, and other cottage hospitals, the population weren't as old. You know, you can see the demographic here on the island with 25% of our population being over the age of 65. That's a massive increase, and it's a completely different scenario to what it was when we had cottage hospitals in the past.
There is a statistic here, part of a CCG report, which suggests that although the population on the island is ageing, it's not growing, which suggests that actually the same people are here now that were here 20 years ago, and actually, you know, they were always going to get older. So this is a bit of a short-sighted policy, maybe.
Well, I think you're absolutely right to say that the population's not increased, but the way that healthcare is that we are keeping people alive for longer, and you perhaps couldn't have anticipated that in such a way. You know, you think of how many people over the age of 100 there are now. That would have been unthought of 10, 15, 20 years ago.
You've said in here you've got measures in place to deal with the extra pressure. That includes the Poppy unit at Solent Grange, which obviously we'll come on and talk about later on in the programme. Are the measures that are in place enough? Do you need more urgent places? You open up 9 beds here and, you know, maybe 15 beds up the road. But is that really making a dent in terms of the need? Because, as you say, the argument isn't necessarily about people going to the Beacon when they should be going to the GP. It's people being admitted.
Well, it's making sure we've got the resources in the right place. So again, it's working right across the island with the local authority, with nursing homes, with residential homes, just making sure that we can respond to the needs of the patients. So I think we are working on plans, and I think they will make a difference.
All right, let's talk CQC report then, which it all kind of links together, really. As of the 8th of September, the Isle of Wight NHS Trust was judged to require improvement. And there were certain areas which were really particularly bad that they had to issue immediate warnings on. It was things like the pressure on beds meant people are being moved between wards, weekend discharges were being delayed, staffing levels too low, there was issues with the way A&E were triaging people. Let's talk about some of those issues. What was your reaction to that CQC report, and what's happened since?
Okay, well, I think at the time, as I think we said, we got 7 out of 10. But as you know, that means we require improvement. So we're disappointed. We'd wanted to be at least good in terms of the ratings. We did have some immediate concerns and a warning notice issued. But what I can tell you now is that warning notice has been lifted. So we had 26 things we had to put right. And we met with the CQC a couple of weeks ago. They were really pleased with the progress they've made. They said they couldn't believe the things that we'd done in the timescale. So they've lifted the warning notice. Now, that's great. I'm really, really pleased. However, we haven't yet got a good rating. So still a lot of work to do. You talked about a number of issues in there, certainly around patient moves. We are monitoring patient moves much more closely than we used to. We can say that we are focusing on those particularly frail patients that shouldn't be moved. And we are auditing that. And we've made massive strides in it. So patients who are particularly sick and particularly frail, we can say that they haven't been moved during the month of December, for instance. An audit showed us that. So I'm really pleased with that progress, but it's not enough. I want to be good. In fact, I want to be outstanding. And I think that's the same for all of our staff. So we are working very, very hard on that. You talked as well about staffing numbers. We are recruiting extra nurses. The Trust Board approved 55 posts to be recruited to. We had a question in our members meeting the other day saying, well, is that all new posts or you know, what's the mix in there? So 26 vacancies we're getting filled and 29 of those are new posts.
Do you have an issue bringing people to the island? Is there a staffing issue in terms of filling those vacancies?
I think generally there is, but at the moment, everybody's trying to recruit nurses. So we're not alone in struggling to recruit. There is a national shortage of nurses. And I think, as you know, we've been to the Philippines to recruit nurses, and we're really pleased to do that. We did Filipino recruitment a number of years ago, and they're fantastic nurses. And the quality of those people that we've recruited this time are really really excellent, so we're looking forward to them joining us.
What's staff morale like, especially off the back of that report? And, you know, there just seems to be an issue with getting people into nursing. When my mum was a nurse, and it was a respected post, you know, and that was a really good, valued profession to go into. There doesn't seem to be that kind of... among young people, that kind of take up into nursing now. What's gone wrong? Do you think that morale is low because of it, and what can be done there?
Okay, picking up on the morale issue first then. I think when you get a report that comes back and says that, you know, you require to improve your services, it's bound to have an effect. But, you know, I think it affects the people who care the most. If you want to be really, really good at what you're doing and you find that somebody says, you know, you're not as good as you should be, that has a devastating effect, and it's bound to affect morale. You know, I didn't feel great when it came through, and I think loads of the staff felt the same. So we are turning that corner, though. Having the warning notice lifted has been a boost for the staff, and certainly having those comments back from the CQC has made people feel really, really positive. Turning to the role of the nurse and recruitment, again, the NHS does take a bit of a bashing nationally, doesn't it? I think it's, you know, politically, people like to say, here's winter, here's what you're doing, things aren't going so well, are they? But I think it's up to us working in the services to really tell people what a fantastic career it is. As I said to you before, you know, I've been doing it for 35, 36 years, and I love doing it. I absolutely think there's a place in the NHS for everyone. It's a real privilege to look after sick people. And I think what we've got to do is to get that message across, particularly starting in schools, saying to people, you know, you don't just have to be a nurse or a doctor, there are many jobs in the NHS, come and join us. And most people that join the NHS don't really want to leave, and I think that's because it's a fantastic thing to do.
There is sometimes criticism that the NHS is manager heavy and that managers don't necessarily know all that much about caring for patients. Is that a valid criticism?
Of course, I'd say no. I am. I'm the chief exec. We're always looking at the number of managers we got across the trust. And you do need managers in order to make sure that services run well. So I don't think we've got too many managers. Looking at them losing touch with the front line, certainly it's really important for me, my executive team, the trust board, all of those people in senior management roles to get back out there and get onto the wards and work alongside people. And for instance, I had the privilege of working alongside one of our medical staff a few weeks ago now for a few hours in the accident emergency department, and it's really important for me to remember why I'm doing my job. It's here to support those frontline staff and make their lives easier, make the patient care better at the front line.
I mean, we should say, in fairness, the CQC report, there were lots of positives in here, and comments about the integrated care hub working very well. Pharmacy service was sectioned out for a special mention as being very effective. There were very worrying, however, issues with the way that children were treated, especially when they came in through A&E, and a publicised case fairly recently in which a very young child was the victim of a shaking incident. I mean, what reassurances can you give to people about how children are dealt with through the NHS Trust?
Okay, one of the aspects of our warning notice was indeed the fact that we were slightly confused about where children went in the emergency. I can say that's one of the things we're now compliant with.
So what were some of the examples of that? I mean, how does that play out when someone brings a child into A&E?
Okay. The way it was before, so not the way it was, the way it is at the moment. So to be really, really clear about that, we've got a children's unit up at the top of our hospital, an accident emergency at the front. And sometimes there would be slight confusion over whether the ambulance should be delivering the child to the front door or to the paediatric unit. And I think that can cause problems for people. So to be really clear now, we know exactly what the process is. We have children's nurses now in the accident emergency department. And actually, only today I opened an email from somebody saying how much better the service is, how great it is to have children's nurses in the emergency department. So I'm confident now that we have a system for caring for our children who come through with emergency conditions. It's much better.
Don't forget, by the way, sorry to jump in, Karen, you can have your say today. You can text us, IW space and a message. Send it into 81222. You can tweet us. We're at iWhite Radio. You could give us a call if you like, 822-002, and find us on Facebook as well, and leave your comments there. I just want to come on and talk a little bit about winter planning. I mean, we have sort of touched on this. The island's received £2.4 million to get the NHS through this winter. How does that stack up in terms of what you need to spend?
Okay, we do need to spend that. So certainly we need that money for the winter pressures. And in common with other areas, we received extra winter pressure money. I think that reflects the pressure felt right across the NHS at the moment in terms of this particular winter. You talked about the poppy unit earlier. That's certainly one of the things that we funded out of the winter pressure money.
Now, I mean, we must touch on the poppy unit. The place where it's located has had an extremely bad report. Just explain to me the relationship between what you do there and the residential side. And I mean, what reassurances can you give there that patients who are told they're being sent off to the poppy unit are going to feel OK about it?
OK, what I can say is it's completely separate. So the services provided in that floor, which is the poppy unit, is completely separate from the rest of the residential home. I've seen what the unit looks like. It's absolutely fantastic. We've talked to some of the patients that are there. They're really pleased with the care that they're getting, and they're really pleased with the environment that they're being cared for in. So it's our staff, our services in somebody else's environment.
And yet you entered into that agreement, however separate, knowing that the CQC findings were going to come out about Solent Grange. I mean, in terms of how that's going to play out, in terms of islanders reading the headlines and thinking, well, hang on a second, why did the Trust enter into an agreement when it already knew about those findings?
OK, we're not being cared, the patients aren't being cared for by the Solent Grange staff, so we are completely separate to the Solent Grange. Now, for us, the opportunity presented itself because they had an empty floor. We talked to other nursing homes and residential homes across the island to try and secure some space, but there simply wasn't any. So this was the opportunity for us. And I can only say really strongly that we are separate from what's going on in the rest of Solent Grange. So it's purely using the facility, and the facility is fantastic, you know, single rooms. It's a really nice place for people to be cared for. And we have our staff in there, and our facilities, and our standards, and our governance. So it's part of the Isle of Wight NHS services.
In terms of, you know, the policy of sending patients out to a third-party location, I mean, how does that play out? Is that a money-saving thing, or is that really in their best interests? Should you not be building an extra ward in the back of the hospital, maybe?
I suppose I always say this, that hospital isn't necessarily the right place for everybody. So when you're better, you shouldn't be in a hospital bed. We all heard about hospital-acquired infections. If you need to be in hospital, it's a really good place to be. But actually, you shouldn't stay there any longer than you need to, because complications can occur as a result of that. So it's absolutely right that those patients go out and are cared for in the poppy ward in Solent Grange.
Doesn't that exacerbate your staffing issue, that you're sort of sending your staff to other locations, they're not there when you've suddenly got pressure and you need them to be on another ward, for example?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we need to do that. We've got plans to do it. So it certainly puts pressure on, but we have contingency plans around that. And I guess, again, addressing the issue about beds, it's really important not just to think about beds, it's to think about patients and nurses that can safely staff those beds. So in previous years, I think it's been OK for the NHS to open up beds and not worry too much about the nursing staff. But we're really, really mindful of the safety consequences of opening beds when you don't have enough staff. So I can absolutely say we wouldn't be opening beds if we didn't have nurses to staff them. So you can't just build another ward out the back of the hospital. You'd need a number of nurses to staff those beds, so it's not really a solution.
But is that something you can work towards? I mean, you can put the plans in place and you know, for next winter have said, well, we are recruiting, we are going to fill those places.
But they don't need to be here. So as I kind of said a bit earlier in our conversation, you know, today we've got 24 people who don't need to be in hospital beds. So why would you build another ward for it? And that's quite a difficult discussion to have sometimes, because people assume if you just built a whole load more beds somewhere, then that would solve the problem. It really wouldn't solve the problem. What we need to do is to make sure that patients are cared for in the right environment for them. So it may not be a bed that suits them. It may be that they need care package in their own home. They need additional help. help at home, and it's very important that we provide the right kinds of things for them.
Does the island face a bit of a unique staffing challenge? Is there a situation, for example, in a big inner city London hospital where they have more available to them to sort of draft in?
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I think the Solent sometimes for staff is a bit of a barrier. But we do need to make sure that we tell people how fantastic it is to work on the Isle of Wight. And certainly senior people going out to meetings on the mainland, it's really important that they tell people what a great opportunity it is to work in a unique health system. So really encouraging people to come to the Isle of Wight. We've got lots of examples as well of people who've come over here to work specifically with us because of our innovative ways of working.
All right, Karen Baker, thank you very much indeed. We'll go to a quick break. We're also joined by Andy Holobon, who's head of comms here as well. It's just after 1:30. We'll have a quick break. And when we will come back, we'll talk about some of the issues affecting the island's NHS. Don't forget, you can keep your comments coming in.
Friday Report, getting to the heart of island issues. Isle of Wight Radio.
Welcome back. This is the Friday Report. And joining me on the show today, Karen Baker, who's the Chief Executive of the Isle of Wight NHS Trust, and Andy Holobon, who's Head of Comms at the Trust. Just a bit of an update, a non-health-related update, if you'll give me 5 seconds here. There is a fire at Wood Street in Ryde. The fire service are in attendance, and there are 3 appliances there. So if you find yourself in that area today and you're wondering why it's very busy, that'll be why. And I would imagine best to try and avoid the area if you can while that incident is ongoing. You'll find more on the website, iwradio.co.uk. In the meantime, you can text us, you can tweet us, you can call us, 822002. Let's talk, if we may, mortality rates on the Isle of Wight. This is one of the things that was picked up in the CCG report. And it talks about mortality rates from cardiovascular disease under 75 and also from cancer and early cancer detection rates. What, Karen Baker, are mortality rates like here compared to other areas, and do they need to be improved?
Okay, what I can say is that our mortality rates are going down. So they are lower than they've ever been here on the Isle of Wight. We certainly had an issue around mortality rates a few years ago, but we've done an awful lot of work in looking at how we code comorbidities. So that's saying when people are ill, do we capture all of their illnesses? Because if you put the wrong things down, then you sometimes think people might have died of things that they haven't done. So there's some work been done around that. We've increased our medical staff. In response to the CQC, we've certainly got better pathways of care for our patients. And this has resulted in lowering of our mortality rates in the health service.
Why were they higher here on the Isle of Wight than perhaps they might have been?
Well, again, I think it's a mixture of things, but I think one of the main reasons was that we weren't really capturing how ill the patients were. And that certainly was the case when I arrived here on the island. And I think there are many reasons for that, but some of the reasons are that when you're working in a really busy inner city hospital, people don't know each other quite so well. So, for instance, if you've got somebody who is regularly using the health service, then the general practitioner will know what's wrong with them. The hospital consultant knows what's wrong with them. So when the hospital consultant communicates with the general practitioner, they may just come up with one or two conditions. They won't do the whole medical history. So, for instance, if I had a knee replacement and I had 4 or 5 other things wrong with me, and I don't put all of those things down on the form, it looks like I might have died as a result of a knee replacement. And actually, I could have had, you know, many other things. I could have been significantly ill with other things. So we hadn't been coding our conditions properly.
So is that all it was? It was just a lack of coding?
I think that was the main reason, certainly. That was the main reason for it.
Okay, all right. Let's talk a little bit. I mean, I've got something here. When I was doing some research for this, it is very much statistics and graphs, and yeah. You're overwhelmed by facts and figures, and it's very difficult to try and pull out things here that you know, that it's all kind of so many statistics, it overwhelms you. I mean, there's a graph here that suggests that maybe the Isle of Wight's struggling when it comes to avoidable emergency admissions. and this is from the CCG reports, and it's talking about people, you know, coming into to A&E, but maybe when they don't need to. I mean, what do we know of that?
Okay, certainly, as I alluded to earlier, people do come to A&E sometimes for minor ailments. But again, I don't think that that's something that's particularly unusual. Prior to working here, I worked in Southampton, and we had a number of people who came to A&E for perhaps a reason that could have been dealt with somewhere in the community. So I don't think we're unusual in that. And we do use campaigns to say to people, perhaps you need to go to your pharmacy. So, you know, if you've got colds, coughs, you've seen the campaign that we've got out at the moment saying, consider going to your pharmacist first if you've got illnesses. Also, your general practitioner. Those people are out there to help you deal with things that don't need to come to the accident emergency department.
This might be something to bring Andy in on here. We get an awful lot of information sent to our news desk about how the patients do need to make, you know, better choices about where they go, and lots of advice on where you should take certain conditions. If you're the patient at home and your overriding motivation is, well, I don't want to bother the doctor and I don't want to go to A&E if I'm not required to, and it's very, very difficult as a patient to make a judgment call on how ill you are.
Really, Lucy, if you're in any doubt, then you should ring 111. It's an island-based service. They've got the clinical expertise there to help people and direct them to the right service.
Invariably, though, if there's even the remotest of suggestions that there's anything that doesn't tick the box that they've got, you're dispatched up to the Beacon.
Well, I mean, they will dispatch you elsewhere, so they will advise you if the presentation of the facts to them is, you know, of a particular nature, they'll divert you to the right place, whether or not that's the pharmacy, your own GP, or to come into the Beacon Centre. So they really are the best place to call in the first instance.
But it does feel like the onus is on the patient to know what's wrong with them before they've actually spoken to a medical professional. In this age of Google, you know, and you sit there and think, well, I've got this symptom, and you go on to, and you're like, that, oh my goodness, and the things that come up, you've sort of developed another symptom before you've even left the house. I mean, the access to medical professionals for patients surely is a thing that needs to be improved, because you don't know what's significant about what's happening to you and what that might trigger in terms of, you know, ticking the right box to get the right diagnosis.
Well, certainly in the future, I think there's things that we can do to make that access more available. So, for instance, how about consultations by Skype, where you, if you're web-enabled, you could log on and talk to a practitioner, whether or not that's a nurse or a GP, and see the person and show them the condition at the same time. So there's lots of innovative ways we could work in the future, but it takes a bit of time to get there. In the meantime, there's lots of options, and we'd encourage people to follow the advice which we've given.
And Karen, you touched on how GPs talk to the hospital, talk to community nurses, that sort of conversation that goes on. People seeing people in different situations, people saying, well, I've got this wrong with me, but maybe not telling the next person that they see. How much information falls through the gap there between those conversations? How much isn't said? And are there situations that arise where actually if the GP had said to the hospital, well, there is this, or the hospital had said to the community nurse, oh, yes, there was that time, that actually quite a lot of these problems wouldn't have occurred?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point that you're making there. I suppose it is about people having the right conversations with each other and communicating well. Andy alluded to our 111 service here, and that's actually part of an urgent care hub for us. And within that hub, we've got not only 111, we've got 999 services, we've got clinical help desk, we've got social care, we've got community nurses, we've got allied health professionals in there. So they can all have those conversations with each other in the urgent care hub. And certainly within the community, what we're doing is building multi-professional teams. Now, we've divided the Isle of Wight into three localities. We've appointed GP leads to those localities to work alongside lead locality nurses, and then multi-professional teams there. And that includes social care. It also includes a voluntary sector and the third sector. So we are really, really focusing on people working very closely together, because it's all about the way teams work and the way they communicate with each other. But more than that, we need to get an underpinning IT system. And people often say to me, oh, do you know, I've had to give my details so many times, so many different people. I've had to tell my story in so many different ways. And we are working really hard with our partners to design web systems that mean you only have to do that once.
I mean, in 2015, I'd be saying that's a little bit late in the day.
Well, I guess you would. But if you think about it, we did try to do this nationally. Everybody says, yeah, it's National Health Service. And we had an enormous National Health Service project to try and get IT systems right across the NHS. And you think that should be a simple thing to do. But one of the blocks to that is that each GP surgery has the potential to have a different IT support system. So then they all have to talk to each other. Here on the island, we're really lucky. Our general practices decided to have the same system. And certainly other people talked to me and they said, you know, you're so lucky to have that in the first place, because it means there's just one interface to sort out there. And we do have a lot of information already going across the system, but I think that can be improved to get it into one patient record. And we are certainly ahead of the field nationally in doing that.
When you sit outside as a casual observer of the NHS and, you know, you can applaud everything it does and you can appreciate how amazing it is to have the NHS compared to if you're in other countries where there are nothing like the free facilities that are on offer here. It is also very difficult to understand how all that public money still leaves these situations whereby, you know, there is no automatic right of conversation between the GP and the hospital, for example, that data isn't shared, that when I come in as an accident and emergency patient, you don't already know what my medical history is.
Yeah, sure. I think data sharing, again, is another hot topic. So it's not as simple as you think. Some people are actually quite nervous about data being shared between professional groups. So you need to make sure you have the patient's consent to do that before you set the system up. So you have to be very, very careful with people's personal data.
Do patients, do you think, need to be a lot more savvy when using the NHS in 2015 than they have in previous years?
I don't think so. I think we're trying to simplify it. So certainly talking about 111 as a way of coming in, previously you wouldn't have had that option. You would have had to think, how on earth do I get around the National Health Service? And we have listened to what the public have said, because it's been hugely confusing before. A whole range of numbers to have to phone to try and get access through. So we really want to listen to the public and to our patients and design services around them. And I think 111 is a really good example of that.
There's a story on the front of the county press today. This is to do with the death of an East Cowes lady. A doctor has been blamed for gross failure in her death and must report to the General Medical Council following a decision by the coroner. Your comments on that particular story?
Well, this is a very, very sad situation. It was a sudden and unexpected death. We'll clearly be reviewing the coroner's findings, discussing the issues with the staff concerned. But really, our deepest sympathies go out to Kathleen's family, friends and colleagues. It really was an awful situation to be in.
At what point are mistakes made by the Beacon due to pressure? And at what point are they down to the individual doctor? And what safeguards are in place in terms of making sure something like this doesn't happen again?
Okay, I mean, health is a very risky business. You know, people are extremely ill when they come into the health service quite often. We do have systems and processes in place. We do try to do everything we possibly can to learn from the mistakes that we've made, which is why we'll be reviewing this particular case to see if there's anything that we could learn from it. Again, sometimes it's down to human error. And all the systems and processes in the world are not going to stop that happening sometimes. But we need to do everything we possibly can. I think the health service needs to take the approach of the airline industry and really make sure that we're as safe as we possibly can be. But again, it's a really tragic case.
Let's talk about community nursing and also that push towards working closer with the Isle of Wight Council and in terms of delivering certain services. Health visitors particularly, I've always seen as a very much kind of traditional community nurse sort of role. Currently under the banner of acute care, though, which seems like completely the other end of the scale in terms of medical care. What's happened there and what's the future of health visitors on the island?
Okay, health visiting is very important. We've actually doubled the number of health visitors we've got here on the island because they have a key role in the health of the nation. So it's really about preventative end of things. They're not in the acute sector, And I suppose
they're being managed by acute services at the moment.
Well, what I need to explain a bit there. So we are a unique kind of service. So we have got acute health services. So we've got hospital services and all things attached to that. We also run the community services, and that includes health visitors, school nurses, people that traditionally wouldn't have been in the acute sector. We have mental health services within our remit, and also the ambulance service. So I think that gives us an advantage of being able to see things right across the patient pathway. So patients come from their own home through the acute services and back out again, and actually working alongside social care means that we can really focus all the things that we do on the needs of the patients at whatever time they are in their journey.
But that role, it will move towards being under the control of the council, I understand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So why in the interim between sort of moving them over there, have they been put in acute? What's the process?
Yeah, I suppose, again, they're not in acute. They're in a health service that's, it's a community service, it's part of a community service. But I think moving them across into the local authority, I think it doesn't really matter where you place your practitioners, as long as they're doing the right thing for the patients. So as long as you're focusing in on what are the needs of this patient, it doesn't matter if you work for the local authority, the acute service, community service or whatever, if you're doing the right thing.
I mean, can you be certain that the managers in charge of these individuals know the pressures that they're under? Because I imagine a community nurse who's out and about on the day-to-day knocking on doors is in a very, very different position than a nurse who's based in a ward that deals mainly with elderly people, and then again a different position from maternity and paediatrics. They're all very different roles. Do the managers know enough to be able to iron out the nuances among those?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and I think traditionally I would have said no. I think, you know, once people are out there in their own homes, how could the managers know what's going on? But what I can say is that one of our senior nurses, Jenny Edgington, has been looking at what we call the acuity independency. So that's how sick patients are and what their needs are across the community. And she's actually developing with her colleagues a way of us looking at what it is they're doing. So looking at the number of contact hours you need for each individual patient. And looking at it in that way, you can see if you've got enough community nurses, because you're right, it does look like an invisible bit of the workforce. But I think it's so important that we get that right, particularly as we wanted to keep patients in their own homes much more.
Let's talk, if we may, about this. It's the word privatisation, which I know you've got very strong views about. This is about the partnership working with Rylehurst, which it has been suggested is privatising the NHS. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, as I've said before, absolutely not. There's no way I'd agree with any privatisation of the NHS. I think the point you made earlier about it being free at the point of access, clearly it's not a free service. We all pay for it, but it needs to be free at the point of access. And any moves towards changing that would be something that I very much oppose.
Opposed, but I mean, given the way the government has its control over the service, I mean, are you really in a position to stop it if it is the slippery slope towards that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think I'd rather not work in a health service that starts charging people at the front door and on the basis of... we need to treat people on the basis of need. So it's very, very important that we maintain that ethos in the NHS. For me personally, that's my personal view. In terms of Rylehurst, what we're doing there is that we're joining into a partnership with them so they can help us modernise our estate. And those of you that are up to St Mary's will realise that some parts of the estate are really good and really modern and new, but other parts certainly need some refurbishment in order to provide excellent healthcare in 2015. We also have a number of facilities across the island. We need to take those into account. And Rylehurst are estate experts. We do have an estates department. They're absolutely fantastic, but they're not really massive estates department. And, it's really useful for us to go and speak to people who are experts in this field, because we do specialise in health. So Rylehurst are there to say, what do we need to do? How are we going to do it? How are we going to provide the best service for your patients?
As we head towards the general election, your thoughts on... I mean, it's one of those things that no one's really able to call it at all this year, but do you have concerns as we go towards that maybe, come May, things are going to be a very different picture?
Well, I suppose they may well be a very different picture, but I guess my message to everybody is that we need to concentrate on improving the quality of care that we give to our patients. So whoever's sitting there in Whitehall, whoever's running the country, I think as a health service and health and social care service, we just need to make sure we're doing the right thing for our patients.
And very finally, the future of NHS on the Isle of Wight. We literally have a few minutes left now. I mean, is it going to stay as it is? Are we going to have all of the services that we currently have? Is there a fear that maybe some of those services will be taken away to the mainland? What reassurances can you give there?
Okay, I think we need to do the right thing again. So you'll be aware at the moment that we do some of our services in partnership with some mainland providers. So for instance, cardiology services, we work very closely with Portsmouth hospitals. Our cancer services, we work very closely with both Portsmouth and Southampton. And I think the way for us to ensure that we continue to provide really high quality services is to have more of those partnerships, not to become insular and isolated, but actually to learn from those people and also to teach them some of the excellent things we're doing here. I think earlier I said to you that we've got some fantastic things going on here on the island, and we often forget to publicise them really, really widely. So I think we need to do more of that. We do need to work in partnership with others, and we do need to safeguard the services we've got here in terms of providing quality services for people.
Karen Baker with 10 Seconds to Go. Thank you very much for your time today joining us on the Friday Report. And Andy Hollybourne, Head of Comms, thank you very much for your time. As always, you can join us next week for the Friday Report, and we have a budget special. I am sure it will be a lively one. Don't forget to get your questions and comments in for our budget special next week. Tom Stroud's on your radio next. And just an update, Wood Street in Ryde currently closed. That's due to a building fire, so do avoid the area if you can, please. Very nearly 2 o'clock. We're here with the news next.
Friday Report with Lucy Morgan on Isle of Wight Radio.